Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester On The Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is February 27. It's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. We've got a phenomenal guest, Dr. Oren M. Levin-Waldman. He wrote an article most recently that he entitled New York City and Amazon. It is business as usual in the global economy. And we're going to talk to him about his analysis of the whole situation. But before we do that, just in case you're unfamiliar, Oren M. Levin-Waldman is a professor at the Graduate School for Public Affairs and Administration at Metropolitan College of New York. He's a research scholar at the Binziger Institute for Sustainable Prosperity. He's also a faculty member in the Milano School for International Affairs, Management, and Urban Policy at the New School. So good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good morning.
Well, it's a pleasure for you to literally decipher this whole situation with the inducement that was worked out by the governor of the state of New York, Mario Cuomo, and then I believe also de Blasio, the mayor of New York, was involved, and very few others, if at all, in the initial stages. And they came up with a package that required the state to give tax credits valued at $3.4 billion. That was to lure Amazon in, as you wrote it. And at the same time, the return over a 25-year period would amount to $27 billion. Why didn't that fly?
I think it didn't fly because a lot of people were protesting this particular, package. And the package, well, it's a lot of money, and it's no different than what a lot of cities do in order to attract investment. Basically, we're in a situation, we've been in a situation for several decades now where all cities, states and localities are competing with one another for investment dollars. So they're, in some ways, they're racing to the bottom to outdo the other in terms of what kinds of inducements they can offer, whether it's tax abatements. But the, more importantly, what they're trying to do is create what could be called favorable business climates. And those favorable business climates usually include tax abatements, relaxation of regulations, and in some cases includes the use of the powers of eminent domain to acquire property, clear it, and then, you know, turn it over to whomever to develop it for the new business that will come along. And what you're hoping to get from this is the creation of jobs. So you sort of have this odd paradox. On the one hand, you have local officials representing their constituents. They're supposed to bring jobs into the district, into the localities, and they're representing their constituents by essentially courting outside interests, people who actually did not vote for them. And so in some cases, those interests are contrary to one another. So what you had here was a great deal of protest stirred up by several local politicians, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez among most prominently most among them, and basically they were able to basically anger, I guess, Amazon enough that they pulled out. Now, I think the other issue for Amazon was there was a concern that the plant would be unionized because, you know, this is a New York's a union town. So they didn't want that necessarily to happen. Still, you know, it would have been better to play the game, as Peggy Noonan put it in the Wall Street Journal on Saturday, to basically, you know, not lead the protests right now, you know, let Amazon come, and then you lead a protest against the anti-unionization. And once they're already here, they're here. It's not so easy to pick up and leave again. It would cost them more money,
right,
but at least the jobs would have been created. And I think the sad part is that, you know, yes, it's $3.4 billion that you're going to spend on this investment, but you're expecting to get $27.5 billion over the next 25 years in revenue. That's revenue the city and the state desperately need. And what you've done now is by chasing Amazon away, and I'm not saying they're the best firm to invest, but they're behaving no differently than any other firm. But what you're saying, you're sending a message out to other potential investors, this is not the place you want to come to.
Yeah. It's very, very intriguing that I know, for example, without this $27 billion over 25 years, and people are always concerned that deals are worked out, but the jobs aren't created. There is no real oversight to see if those jobs were created. There's no clawback mechanism in case you don't create the jobs. There is oversight. If they say, if Amazon said they're going to produce 25,000 jobs at 150,000 a head on average, and then once they were set up, they were going to expand it up to 40,000 people over an additional 8 years. And this time, I think we got quite smart in New York, didn't we? Because we said if you don't produce those jobs, then there was a clawback mechanism. Everything had to really quite fit in. So this was it seemed from what was said, but I never read the paperwork. I don't think it ever became public, certainly not to an operation like us. But wasn't it quite clear that they were going to be producing unbelievable jobs? It wasn't a $15 an hour job. It was a $150,000 a year job. And weren't all the dots, the I's dotted and the T's crossed on this particular project?
I don't know the details of the project, and I don't know exactly what was promised or what Amazon agreed to do. I think it's just this sense that you have this level of protest, and the community is enraged by the fact that public money is being spent to attract a extremely wealthy investor. And, you know, the job, and I think the point is the jobs that are being created are not necessarily jobs that are going to be of immediate benefit to people who live in the district. You know, people who need a job are not going to necessarily get one. You're going to basically employing people from outside the city, people who have skills and abilities. And so they're going to be attracted to work here, and that's going to raise housing costs, in New York, the immediate area. It's going to raise housing costs in Connecticut and other suburban communities. It's actually going to push, because housing costs go up in the immediate area, and so too do apartment rentals. It's going to push a lot of people who are on the edge of being able to afford to live there out to the periphery.
Yes.
And so basically it's detrimental to these people. On the other hand, the tertiary effects would be considerable. You will create other jobs in other areas where they may find employment, at the lower end of the pay scale. But that's a more long-term prospect. It's not immediate. What Ocasio-Cortez was saying is, well, we have to oppose Amazon because they're exploiting workers by not allowing unionization. I mean, that's absurd on its face when you're talking about the jobs they are creating are paying a minimum of $150,000 a year. They're hardly being exploited.
Well, the thing is, how do we have all those positive programs of support to people at the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder, whether it be medical support, medicine, or the health benefits, the Social Security benefits, and just so many other aspects that make it livable, even though at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale. And without an infusion of additional money that's coming in to people who are well-skilled, as opposed to people who are probably not 18-year-olds with little education, but actually much older and may have somehow missed out on getting retrained for better-paying jobs, How do you balance those two if you can't afford to, to take care of people at the lower end? Where are the supports if you don't have the money?
I mean, this is the dilemma that urban communities have been in for decades now. Again, you have to attract investment. The politics of urban politics have been defined by development and redevelopment. You're trying to attract investment in to replace an industrial infrastructure which has all but disappeared. So what you're replacing it with are service sector jobs. Most of the time, you know, you're replacing old industrial jobs with, you know, low-paying waterfront development, restaurants and hotels and things of that nature, but these are not necessarily high-paying jobs. And they're not necessarily jobs that require a great deal of skill, although some of them probably require good soft skills, being able to communicate well and being attractive in the sense that, people want to patronize your business. But that having been said, at the same time, you, in order to meet the needs of your community, those who have been left behind, the so-called underclass that can't find work because the jobs have disappeared, you need more to raise taxes in order to provide those benefits, greater public assistance. By doing so, you're creating an unfavorable business climate, which is contrary to investment. That's essentially the issue.
I understand. So it's so compelling. For example, I think that the state of New York has promised and yet not delivered about $4.5 billion in funding to boards of education across the state. And I'm saying to myself, well, if we made this investment within 2 years' time, even though it wouldn't have been allocated all to education in one shot, but the point is that we would have been able to meet those promises within the 2 year time slot and still had 23 more years to go, where you could have used it for other things. There are some exuberant projects on the works, trying to keep the cost of transportation down, such as the subway system, the MTA, Long Island Railroad, the New Jersey Transit, Metro North. All of these things are coming into play, and we haven't invested in all of this. How do we pay for all of this? Or is it just talk and we're not going to? And people will be able to survive and others won't.
It could be talk on one level. On the other hand, if you attract investment, then that's how you pay for because the investment creates tax revenue. Tax revenue enables you to basically finance new programs. Or needed programs for people who are left behind. So that's the dilemma many localities find themselves in, and states too, in particular. Now, what's also going on here is, look, New York has had an unfavorable business climate for years now. Taxes are exceedingly high, and they've been too high for decades as well. And, and now that people have lost the SALT deductions, there's no reason why people, if they can afford to move out of the state, won't, and many, in fact, will. And so you run the risk of losing a lot of taxpayers that way, too. And the question remains, why could we have taken the money instead of offering specifically all these inducements to Amazon, maybe lower taxes across the board, in an attempt to create a more favorable business climate? Could we have taken some of this money and invested into educational opportunities for people so they could acquire the skills necessary to work in an Amazon? This is the kind of thing we should have been looking at, and communities should be looking at, generally speaking, but they haven't. They've been sort of playing this short game here of, let me see if I can get immediate investment. And the reality is, many local officials, state officials too, feel their backs are against the wall. They often feel they have absolutely no choice but to engage in this kind of partnership.
It was an article you wrote a while back, and I don't remember the exact title, but it was all about the politicians, had nothing to do with the electorate. Seemingly that was the case. And here in this case, I don't want to blame everything on Ocasio-Cortez, but certainly when Andrea Stewart Cousins, who's the Democratic majority Senate conference leader, she designated this guy, Michael Janaris, a senator, to this board, that if there was one person on this board that oversaw this whole investment with Amazon, didn't agree, then the whole thing would be scuttled. But it was all about him, and it's all about her. She wanted to show that she was independent of the governor. She was going to be able to forge her own path. And Janaris was kicked off because he wasn't included in the discussion. And the way I understood it, I read in the Washington Post, Amazon had approached Janaris three times, and he refused to even talk to them. And that's when Bezos said, "I'm out of here." So yeah, what's it all about?
Even De Blasio has been backtracking and saying, well, you know, even though he was a player in trying to get him to come, he's saying, well, they obviously didn't understand New York culture. You can't have it both
ways. Maybe we don't understand business. If you're dealing with one of the richest, I think he's the richest man in the world at the moment. The bottom line is he could pick up and go wherever he wants. And evidently he did.
Not only could he do that, he made it clear he was going to do that. He made it clear that he could do that before he even came. He
Correct.
Basically launched this so-called competition for the H2Q facility. And basically, he basically put all these cities in this competition. So he created this drama surrounding where the new headquarters would be located. It didn't have to be that way.
No, that it didn't. It was an insult, actually. But the question then becomes, quite often I hear the dynamic, well, we shouldn't have to have communities within the state of New York fighting it out, slugging it out for an investment, whether it be, I don't know, in the north part of the county or the south part of the county or in the Bronx or in Rockland or wherever you want to look, or Long Island. But if we're not inducing companies to make investments in different locales, aren't they also trying to do the same thing in the state of New Jersey and Connecticut and Pennsylvania? Aren't we fighting this? Is this a losing battle, or is this the only way to go when we look at the new economies that are coming up now?
I don't know if it's a losing battle, but it's the battle that we have to deal with. States are competing with each other. Localities are competing with each other. Localities are competing with other states. And basically, in some cases, they're competing with one another for foreign investment. So now what we have is a specter of, because of the global economy we live in, we have local and state officials, in some senses, pursuing their own quasi-foreign policy in order to attract investment dollars, even from foreign companies. So, you know, this, when you think about it, it's sort of contrary to the federal nature of the Constitution, which basically holds only the federal government conducts foreign policy, not state and local governments. But if they're offering certain, again, the same array of abatements to foreign companies as they are to local, to domestic companies, then, yeah, you're going to have the same situation.
Unbelievable. And we're also slugging it out on the international stage. It was very interesting. There was an article in today's Financial Times that says Toronto's tech hub is giving Silicon Valley a run for its money. And they're saying a lot of that both has to do with the fact that they're allowing people from foreign countries to work out of Toronto, and they're beating the pants off of Silicon Valley out in California. So that might have different ramifications, but this is a worldwide scene. Is that the same everywhere? Is it really a worldwide situation where everyone's slugging out for investors and investments? I think Google and Amazon and so many other companies, they're all over the world. They got special deals in Ireland or a special deal in Luxembourg or a special deal in the Netherlands, wherever you look. How do you fight this, or is there another dynamic, or is this going to be it right now, maybe in the next 10 or 20 years? That's not going to change, and people will get richer.
This has been the dynamic for, again, several decades now, and it's only getting worse because capital has been ever mobile, and corporations have no loyalty to particular countries. So they go to wherever they can get the best return on their investment, and they can reduce their labor costs, and they can don't have to worry about environmental considerations and other forms of regulation. And basically, that's what they do. And we have to be mindful of that. And if you want to say, okay, but we have certain standards we must maintain in New York, then you are fighting a losing proposition when it comes to attracting investment. So, you know, this is the reality. I'm not saying it's a good reality, and we shouldn't be applauding it, but we have to understand this is the reality that we have to deal with. At the same time, a new member of Congress also needs to understand that it's her job to attract dollars into the city, not to chase them away. Her job is to bring the bacon back to the district, whether it's by, you know, creating a situation or helping to engineer a situation where investors will want to come into the district, or by bringing federal dollars into the district for programs or whatnot, even to create, say, plants like they had an FBI processing plant like Byrd did in West Virginia. He was very good at that.
Yeah.
Creating jobs for West Virginians by bringing federal dollars in to create jobs. Now, that's not what she's doing. She's actually taking credit. She's bragging that she's chasing this company away, and then go on to say, well, people can not work. We'll just give them an income for not working.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, that's not coming about very, very, very soon. I mean, that's being tried in a lot of places, and it's failed for whatever reasons. Maybe it didn't give enough opportunity for these things to come into play. But you pointed out in your article as well, she won her position as a congressperson, and she won it, but nobody sent her there to scuttle a deal with Amazon. It was like you said, to bring home the bacon, and yet why is her attitude still resonating when it undermines the purpose of people in governance? What are they doing then if they're not serving the public interest? Or is the way they're serving the public interest, as far as she's concerned, only the very poor who are unskilled, who need subsidy, and there's no way else to pay for anything else? Because it keeps the atrocity of not being able to pay for schools and infrastructure at bay, and it keeps it at the same level. And so there's no advancement. It's just decay. At least that's what it seems to me.
My sense is that she has no idea how to represent her district. And she basically won with a very small majority of her constituents. And she won the primaries based on a very small turnout. You know, it's not even the whole district that supported her. And so she's using the oppositions, particularly in conjunction with social media, to sort of get out of a larger message to promote herself for bigger things. So she's really not into representing her district, and she's no different than a lot of other politicians.
Absolutely. You're right about that. There was one very compelling example that you pointed out, and that was in Pole Town, which was a neighborhood in Detroit, and that involved General Motors. Can you go over that? That was unbelievable, actually. I did not know of it at all.
This is one of the most famous and one of the most egregious cases of a public-private partnership. And as I suggested, the old public-private partnerships, it was kind of implicit, was this idea that the public sector would basically have an infrastructure prepared, ready for people who create jobs. We also have an educational system that would prepare people to work in the jobs that would in fact be created. The expectation was that once the public sector did its thing, the private sector would in turn invest and create jobs. The new public-private partnership is this idea that now communities are trying to attract investors by offering all these goodies and these abatements and these relaxation of regulations or whatever else they can, other inducements they can offer. But here, you actually had General Motors approaching the Detroit officials and saying, we will actually create 6,000 new jobs by building two new Cadillac plants. Now, for Detroit, this was a godsend because, GM had been moving out for decades now, and there had been no jobs being created in Detroit. So, and here you have two plants coming in. These are manufacturing jobs, and they felt like they had no other choice but to act. And then GM goes on to say, okay, or demand, we specifically want to locate our plants in this particular neighborhood known as Poletown. Poletown was basically a Polish ethnic community. And so the city has to acquire the land and repair it. That means through the laws of the powers of eminent domain, it must acquire the land, buy properties at fair market value. It basically has to bulldoze those homes. It has to bulldoze cemeteries. It has to bulldoze schools, churches, other civic organizations, businesses, in order for GM to be able to build its plants. And it doesn't have the money, really, to do it. So it has to get money from the state and more money from the federal government. Again, everybody's saying this is a win-win for Detroit, not so win-win for the community that's sort of being dislocated as a result.
Right.
But meanwhile, they, in some cases, community organizers, attempted to take GM to court. The way eminent domain works is once the city condemns property for destruction, using eminent domain, basically it triggers a set of procedures where hearings must be held, and people have the right to appeal or at least raise the question of why this land is being targeted. Then the public officials then have to justify their actions. So eminent domain is really about public justification for a governmental action. It's not necessarily, it's not the same as saying property rights are sacred and they're so sacrosanct that you can never violate it. But it is a way of saying that the sovereign who wants to take somebody's property has to be sure and has to justify it. And because the sovereign has to pay for it, then the sovereign is less likely to do it, at least arbitrarily. So it's essentially a buffer against arbitrary exercise of power and authority by the so-called sovereign. Now, once you've held the hearings and you've used, and public officials are still intent on going through with their plan to condemn these properties, then you have the option of taking the community, the city to court and challenging this decision in a court of law. Now, what typically happens is courts tend to side with the cities. They rarely side with the communities because, after all, they're saying, look, this is an investment. They're coming into the city. And there's a public interest here. You're creating jobs. It's so compelling, this public interest, they claim, that it trumps individual property rights. And you're being compensated for it anyway. But you're not really compensating somebody for the loss of their business because you have to establish it all over again someplace else. So they're actually going to lose money.
Right.
And the cost of relocating elsewhere where property values may be more expensive, you're not really compensating them for that. So basically, in some cases, the courts laugh people out the door when they tried to challenge this particular decision. Now, it turned out a few years later, GM decided to pick up and leave anyway. There was no obligation to stay. Now, it raises the question, if you're going to offer these inducements, get some kind of written contract.
Right.
Forbidding a GM from moving or requiring that they make a commitment to stay for a minimum of 10, 15, 20 years, whatever. But that didn't happen in this case.
And have we wised up? Was new concepts that come forward in the same way as this Pole Town incident? Are we getting guarantees? Are we, you know, putting the companies that want all this stuff done at fault in case they renege? Or that's up to the individual community?
It's up to the individual community, and the reality is there's very little way to enforce it. You can't prohibit somebody from relocating. You can assess them with damages for the decision to relocate, even if they violate a contract, and you can assess them for damages. But, and again, when you talk about multinational corporations, some of these corporations, like GM, even Amazon in particular, they may figure it's easier and more cost effective to pay whatever fines and damages and move anyway.
So in a sense, communities are really at the mercy of these big corporations. They could they get inducements to come in and make investments as well, but there's no guarantee they'll be there. So why do we continue this methodology, or is that, as you say before, it's the only method that we know at the moment that's working? And especially because so much of the old jobs are literally evaporating before our eyes. And is that because of the change and transformation in the type of jobs that are out there today? And we don't evidently have the capacity to ratchet up education so that the kids that are going to school now will be ready in the next 5 or 10 or 20 years.
Well, I mean, if we made it a priority to invest in education, that would be a whole different story. But again, what you really need to do is you need to find a way to reduce taxes and, in many cases, reduce regulations. But because a city like New York has such a large underclass population and people in need, money for providing for their needs has to come from someplace. And because the cost of housing is so high in New York City, you have to provide housing for many people as well, or subsidies in many cases. So this becomes a challenge for communities.
And I guess that's what Ocasio doesn't understand or doesn't comprehend. So she didn't understand. It was interesting that within a day or two of her assault on what was going on in this particular case, this deal, she made it sound that instead of spending the $3.5 billion as an inducement, we should spend the money in education. But it was all tax credits, had nothing to do with the layout of $3.5 billion, and she didn't seem to understand that, which is a mind blower to me.
She doesn't understand a lot of things in the real world. She doesn't understand that there's something called capital flight and capital strike. And if capital wants to go on strike, it doesn't invest. And if you're living in a community, a society, where the reigning economic form of organization is capitalism, not socialism, but where government does not create jobs or doesn't employ people en masse, then you have to allow the private sector to do so. Then you have to create conditions conducive for that kind of investment. So she doesn't understand. That's one thing she doesn't understand. The other thing she doesn't seem to understand is that when you're talking about this money, she's claiming that she now has $3.4 billion to give out to New Yorkers. She doesn't have any money to give out to New York. It's not her money to give out.
Right.
She's one vote in the halls of Congress when it comes to federal appropriations. She has no vote in how the state of New York or the city of New York spends its money.
Right. Just really, really mind-boggling to me. So, you know, it's interesting. We're starting to see an infusion of new dogma in the political landscape. So we're hearing things of socialism. She believes in socialism. This is the new democratic left. It's invigorated a lot of young people. Interestingly enough, it originated with Bernie Sanders, who is, I think, in his 70s. So he's one of these old codgers from another world, not very far removed from my own by a couple of years. But the bottom line, though, is socialism has proved not to really function so well. I was speaking to David Rubin. He was an American that moved to Israel, and he became the mayor of a city called Shiloh. In Israel, they call it Shiloh. And, you know, I was giving an interview with him about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and he was discussing how so many people who went to Israel in its beginning, 1948 on, were Russian immigrants, and all they knew was socialism. And it wasn't until the 1980s, mind you, that was like 22 some odd years later, that Israel threw off this whole socialist concept and made it a different world, and it allowed entrepreneurship to flourish and stuff like that. So it didn't work there. It's been proven not to work there. And it's not working too well either in the Scandinavian countries, now we start to find out. So is this new dogma going to fly? It sounds good, but nobody knows how to pay for it.
Well, it's appealing to people who are having a hard time making it in the new global economy. You know,
yeah.
And I think, you know, the opportunities that existed for our parents' generation no longer seems to exist for our children's generation. So, you know, it's a very appealing idea. And so it's easy to fall back on this idea. Well, we just didn't implement it correctly in these places. If we only implement it more properly, it will work better. I'm not so sure about that. And I'm not saying that unfettered capitalism is the answer. It certainly is not.
No.
But you need to have some kind of balance. What socialism does is it provides a decent diagnosis of the problems that you are confronted with. The solutions are a little bit extreme, but it basically tempers your marketplace. So we have what we call welfare state, lemon socialism. It's a form of socialism, but it's not really socialism in the traditional sense. But it's basically the demos, so to speak, the democratic majority, is getting some recognition or preference for its needs. And they chose that set of policies through the democratic process.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because I forgot about other countries that are struggling. Venezuela has to no end. It was a socialist concept that was imposed by Chavez and evidently failed under Maduro. And there are other examples as well. Venezuela, that was a big one. And they're changing the government to some extent from the good old days of Fidel Castro to this new guy, Canel, I think is his last name. And the supports and subsidies are coming from other countries, and they're still not functioning well. They're not functioning on their own. So they get subsidies from China, they get subsidies from Russia, and they end up owing all of this. And then when the countries go belly up, no one knows what to do.
Yeah.
So where do we go from here now that we've learned this big lesson with Amazon? Does it look likely that people and big business will ever consider investing in this metropolitan area, or has this been the death knell that will forever haunt the New York metropolitan area for many, many, many decades? That's what I'm fearful of.
It's likely to have a deleterious impact on investment in this area for some time to come.
Yeah.
Now, that isn't to say that you won't have a group of politicians and public officials who continue to court investment. I'm sure they will.
Yeah.
And that's what the economic development offices are all about, state and local level, courting investment,
right,
trying to get people to invest and create jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's going to be more difficult to do so because now New York has a history. And what I think investors are concerned about, it's not just the so-called business climate being unfavorable in terms of taxes and regulations, but it's also the sense that if there's been too much political opposition to them getting these inducements, then they're going to say, just like Bezos said, I don't need this.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it was interesting because after he said, I'm leaving, there was calls from New Jersey. Oh, please move to our state, but there's no interest in that, which is truly amazing to me. But he's going to make his investment in Virginia, and that's going to be sufficient. And who knows where he can move next? And it's so interesting because he's so wealthy, he's got so much power, whether it's Amazon or it's Whole Foods that's part of him, and Barnes & Noble is part of him. He owns the Washington Post. You never know, if he's a vindictive character, he might say, you know what, let me call up the New York Times and see if they want to sell. And you know, he'll give him a good price and they're out of there, and then he'll end up controlling the political mouthpieces that drive the equation forward. And at the end of the day, he has the capacity to really win, even if it's in a destructive way, which I think is a little bit frightening when you come to think of it. Is Gennaris going to even survive? That was interesting. Gennaris was appointed, and now he's been dismissed by Andrea Stewart Cousins, and she's got Teflon somehow. She's not getting any flack for it, and yet she was involved very heavily. The Assembly Speaker.
I can't say. I don't know much about the vagaries of New York City politics.
Yeah.
I'll say one way or the other, but
yeah, there's too much of that going on.
You know, again, they play well in some districts and to some constituents in New York City, but I don't think this whole situation is playing well to most in New York City at the moment.
So is this the sort of thing that happens very frequently, but we don't hear about it because it's not a big investor that could have happened? Do a lot of projects fall apart because there's so much consternation and pushback from communities?
I don't know.
Once it begins, it goes.
I don't know how widespread pullbacks are in terms of investment. It certainly happens all the time that investors are striking deals with public officials all over the country to invest.
Yeah.
And that's not going to continue. I think what made this case particularly dramatic and, well-known was the fact that Bezos himself started it. He's the one who called attention to this competition. He basically created this drama surrounding, this drum roll kind
mm-hmm.
of ceremony where he's going to announce
mm-hmm.
the winner of this particular competition. And that in of itself created an opportunity for people to mobilize their opposition in a loud vocal voice, and then first the opposition was so loud, and then his response was he has to make an announcement that he's pulling out. It basically each one ratcheted up the temperature, I don't know that the temperature is ratcheted up quite to the same degree in other communities, but certainly state and local officials are courting investment.
Well, maybe that eclipsed my mind because you mentioned this before, and I guess it didn't strike my heart, so to speak. I know that he started the whole process, but was that unique only to him? Because it seems that the deal had been worked out over about a year's time. The governor was involved, the mayor was involved, and once they announced it is when all hell broke loose, and within less than a week's time, it was over. And everybody went home. They took the marbles and went home, wherever that was. So what should have Bezos done if he wanted to avoid this sort of pushback? And was he blind to the fact that people might actually push back?
I'm sure there's an element of that. I mean, I'm sure he figured this is such a wonderful deal, and they would be grateful.
Yeah.
For the opportunity to roll over and do Amazon's bidding. I'm sure he really thought that. He's doing them a favor, after all, by investing in New York. And they should be thankful. How dare they protest? I don't think he really understood the mentality of New York, New Yorkers. He didn't really understand the culture. And he figured that he'd get away with it. He did not think there would be this kind of blowback. In that sense, de Blasio was right in saying he didn't understand New York culture, but de Blasio was wrong. He was being a little disingenuous when he says that, because he himself was responsible for these inducements being offered to Amazon in the first place.
Right, right. So in a sense, even though he was right in one hand, he was wrong in the very beginning because he was involved in it. So he wants to show two sides of himself now after the fact. And what about the governor? The governor didn't recognize it either? Or seemingly not. I mean, we can't tell exactly what they were thinking when it was happening, but the governor was also unaware or not sensitive to this thing could possibly happen?
I don't know. I can't speak for what was in Cuomo's mind. But, my sense is it's possible that a lot of them probably know there can be this kind of pushback. And they're aware of it, and they're hoping that it won't be. Because, again, they've figured this is the best they can do for attracting investment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So they probably at the end must have considered it to some extent. But in the past, when there was investment, it usually went in the direction of the intent of business and also government. They wanted it to come through, so it did. There wasn't very much pushback. What's the cause of pushback today? Is that part of the new dynamic in politics? Is it because we don't talk to one another as much as we should? And we don't hear each other even when it's expressed? Is that the new politics of the day?
Well, the politics of the day has been, certainly since Trump was elected and then inaugurated, has been that of resistance. And protest movements all over the country, and rallies and marches and this and that. And I think, local communities basically see it's something that has potential to at least raise consciousness, even if it doesn't always work. But it does raise consciousness, so they sort of seem to follow the lead. So if people can resist Trump at the national level, why can't we resist powerful market interests at the local level? We can do the same thing. We'll protest and have rallies and marches against it. And that's basically the playbook that Ocasio-Cortez took from.
Well, if we go beyond what happened here in this particular case, does this also show some of the, I guess, the lack of ethical standards that we have in many levels? Like, for example, we hear that certain countries in the world, they want to sell armaments to one country or the other, and some agree and some disagree. Can one have an ethical standard with all of these things, or is it like it is all about business? It's all about making the sale, no matter what. So you know, how does one do this? And then you also have, like, for example, Saudi Arabia was really trashed for a lot of things that happened, especially with that Khashoggi murder that took place in Istanbul. And the Mohammed bin Salman, he just went to Pakistan, gave him a $20 billion investment, and they're thrilled to pieces, and everything's okay. So how does one do this, or is there no logic to it at the end of the day? It's all about business.
There is no logic to it, but again, these are doing the best they can, what they think is
right.
The best they can. And again, it's a competition, basically, raised down to the bottom. And it's one of the reasons why wage rates have been so stagnant across the country. Communities feel the need to lower wage rates or find ways for wage rates to drop in order to attract people to their communities. What typically happens in many localities is localities then begin to farm out municipal functions to private contractors who can pay a fraction of what the localities were paying to their once municipal workers who were unionized. So that's where the living wage movement comes from at the local level. They're basically protesting the wages they're getting. So then you pass an ordinance requiring those who have a contract to perform these municipal services to pay a, quote, living wage, but the living wage is still less than it would have been, if you had continued to employ the municipal workers at the union rate. So the odd spectacle you have is the same mayors who basically contracted out to private contractors in order for the purpose of creating a favorable business climate as a way of sending a message to would-be investors, are also leading or supporting living wage movements. So they can feel good about themselves and say, see, we're trying to give something back to those workers. But the living wage movement only covers those working for contractors. It's not a citywide minimum by any stretch of the imagination.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean, in a sense, the takeaway when we look at this situation, it does seem to point out that the way we're conducting business is faltering. People are not happy with it. There's a pushback. Look, we've got DPWs in a lot of different communities. They're unionized. The police are unionized. The firefighters are unionized. There's a call for volunteer firefighters in big cities. That's not manageable. The place will burn down before you can get there because traffic is so heavy. Or police officers who are allowed in the last years of their of employment to get many, many extra hours of overtime so that their pensions go through the roof and they're able to retire at sometimes more than the minimum salary of entry into the police department. So they're earning as much as they would have if they just started in the police department. So they may be retiring with a pension of $300,000 and they're taking home $150,000, which is more than you would have actually, which is probably twice the cost of what an entry-level police officer would get. Is this sustainable? Is that the anger? Is that where people are getting upset?
It's one of the sources of anger, the sense that, you know, people are cashing out the taxpayer expenses.
Yeah.
But again, these are whatever contracts were negotiated need to be respected. The problem with many of these contracts is they were never financed to begin with, and the can was kicked down the road, figuring the next administration would take care of it. Next administration comes in, they kick the can down the road further. Then you reach a point where then all of a sudden people are beginning to retire and they want their pensions. And that's why that's the crisis that, again, many states and localities are finding themselves in.
Well, that's the case, but then unions are not being responsive either. They're not winning. They seem to be losing at the losing end, I think more so in the last 5 years than I've ever noticed it before.
Well,
they seem to be losing their juice.
private sector unionism has been in decline for decades now. So the only unionism that seems to be on the rise, if it's rising at all, or the largest segment of the union sector, is public sector unionism. So people have little tolerance for public sector unionism. And even Franklin Roosevelt, when he was signing the National Labor Relations Act, basically took the, which recognized the legitimacy of unions and collective bargaining to prevent social strife and also to build to drive up wages in a depression. He recognized, or he even said, he wasn't sure that the public sector employees should be unionized because they have an oath to serve the public interest. So, you know, here, this idea that, well, if you have police officers, they're members of the union, they're going to go on strike, that doesn't sound, doesn't fit right with a lot of people. And they feel the same way about teachers and other public sector employees. But again, on the other hand, if they can't join a union, then the communities can take advantage of them by not paying them. Because if you have to pay them by raising people's taxes, nobody will vote to pay them.
Wow. Unbelievable. Well, very compelling as usual, Professor. I want to thank you again for explaining so much. I've learned a tremendous amount today. And I want to wish you a good day. And then I want to talk about some of the books that you've written and give people, a synopsis of your expertise. I can't wait to speak to you again. All the best to you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, there we have it, folks. Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. He's a professor, and what I wanted you to know again that he's the professor at the Graduate School for Public Affairs and Administration at Metropolitan College of New York. He's a research scholar at the Binziger Institute for Sustainable Prosperity, and he's also a faculty member in the Milano School of International Affairs, Management, and Urban Policy at the New School. And you may find it really quite interesting to read some of the books that he's written. One is called Restoring the Middle Class Through Wage, again written by Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. The book makes the case for minimum wage as a way to improve well-being of middle-income workers, reduce income inequality, and enhance democracy. And another one of the books that is really quite compelling, well, is called Minimum Wage, a Reference Handbook, published by ABC-CLIO. And the Minimum Wage, a Reference Handbook by Orrin M. Levin-Waldman, discusses how, as of 2014, the minimum wage in Seattle was $15 an hour, which was double the federal minimum wage. And nothing fell apart, which is really quite interesting. But everyone was scared of what could conceivably happen. And also now new in paperback is Wage Policy, Income Distribution, and Democratic Theory by Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. And this is, somebody from Cornell University, Charles Whalen, had said about this new book, Wage Policy, Income Distribution, and Democratic Theory, that Levin-Waldman has put his finger on what may be the central domestic political issue of our time, and the book the widest possible audience. And I think you'll agree if you read it. It's not the easiest of reading, but I personally have found that the more one reads Professor Levin-Waldman's work, the more one can comprehend, because this is not a simple issue. He discusses economic theory. He gives a basis by which he derives his conclusions, and he's not also married to every little thing, and he's able to deduce and rationalize certain behavior patterns, which is really the study that incorporates so much of what he does. And what's fascinating is that because he does such a good job of it, you also learn the theories that go behind the standards of policy. And that informs one to a great extent. And he can show it to you by revealing the behavioral patterns and standards that have come into play when you've got one inducement or another that come into play, whether positive or negative. So you get to understand how the human dynamic becomes part of this petri dish, and very, very exciting to say the least. Well, let's go over to our studio screen. Let's find out what's happening in our neck of the woods. Let's find out what they're doing at the Yonkers Tribune, and then we'll be back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a stenopad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. This is Westchester on the Level. Another number if you want to reach out to the Yonkers Tribune is to call them at 347-415-4326. You can text them, you can leave them a message, or you can call them. That's also the cell phone. So 347-415-4326. And that's for the Yonkers Tribune. So let's cover, there's a lot of stuff that's happened and very, very intriguing as well around the world. So first thing, I guess one of the most powerful stories out there is that President Trump and Kim Jong-un of North Korea, they've opened their second nuclear summit in Hanoi. So North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and President Donald Trump met in Hanoi today for their second summit, with the U.S. president saying he will not back down on U.S. demands for North Korea's denuclearization. Kim and Trump shook hands and smiled briefly in front of a row of their country's flags and banks of press at the Metropole Hotel in the Vietnamese capital of Hanoi. Now, Trump told reporters he thought the talks would be very successful while he was, quote, not walking back on denuclearization, end quote. Asked if he would declare a formal end to the Korean War, Trump said, we'll see. Kim said they had overcome obstacles to hold the summit in Vietnam and had needed patience since their first meeting in Singapore last year. He said he hoped these talks would be successful. Quote, I am certain that an outcome will be achieved this time that will be welcomed by all people, Kim told Trump. I will do my best to make that happen. Now, Trump and Kim are scheduled to hold a 20-minute one-on-one chat followed by a dinner with aides. Trump will be accompanied by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Acting Chief of Staff Mike Mulvaney. Kim will be joined by his top envoy, Kim Jong-chol, and Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho. On Thursday, the two leaders will hold a series of back-and-forth meetings, the White House said. The venue has not been announced, and despite little progress on his goal of ridding North Korea of its weapons programs, Trump appeared to be betting on his personal relationship with North Korea's young leader and the economic incentive after 70 years of hostility between their countries. Quote, Vietnam is thriving like few places on earth. North Korea would be the same and very quickly if it would denuclearize, Trump said on Twitter ahead of his meeting with Kim. The potential is awesome, a great opportunity like almost none other in history for my friend Kim Jong-un. He will know fairly soon. Very interesting, end quote. Trump said late last year he and Kim, quote, fell in love, end quote, and on the eve of his departure for the second summit said they had developed, quote, a very, very good relationship, end quote. Whether the bon ami can move them beyond summit pageantry to substantive progress on eliminating Pyongyang's nuclear arsenal that threatens the United States is the question that will dominate the talks. At their historic first summit in Singapore last June, Trump and Kim pledged to work toward denuclearization and permanent peace on the Korean Peninsula. North and South Korea have been technically at war since the 1950-1953 conflict, with the Americans backing the South, ended in a truce, not a treaty. That first meeting between a sitting U.S. president and a North Korean leader ended with great fanfare, but little substance over how to dismantle North Korea's nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles. U.S. intelligence officials have said there is no sign North Korea will ever give up its entire arsenal of nuclear weapons, which it sees as its guarantee of national security. Analysts say it won't commit to significant disarmament unless punishing U.S.-led economic sanctions are eased. In the run-up to the summit, Trump has indicated a more flexible stance, saying he was in no rush to secure North Korea's denuclearization. He has held out the prospect of easing sanctions if North Korea does something meaningful, quote unquote. Two sides have discussed specific and verifiable denuclearization measures, such as allowing inspectors to observe the dismantlement of North Korea's Yongbyon nuclear reactor, U.S. and South Korean officials had said. And U.S. concessions could include opening liaison offices, ending the war, or clearing the way for inter-Korean projects. Any deal will face scrutiny from American lawmakers and other skeptics who doubt North Korea is truly willing to give up its weapons. So, very compelling circumstance, to say the least. And it's going to be very intriguing to see where this leads. Evidently, interestingly enough, in the U.S. House, they voted to block Trump's border emergency declaration, and the U.S. House of Representatives dealt a blow to President Donald Trump. This was yesterday, approving a resolution blocking him from obtaining funding for a Mexican border wall through his declaration of a national emergency. Dismissing a veto threat by the president, the Democratic-controlled House struck down Trump's emergency declaration by a comfortable margin of 245 to 182, sending the measure to the Republican-held Senate. 13 Republicans joined Democrats in voting to terminate Trump's emergency declaration, which the Republicans issued on February 15. After failing to secure billions of dollars from Congress for the wall. Now, the emergency declaration would allow Trump to find funding for the Mexican border wall, his signature campaign promise, from other sources, notably the Pentagon budget for military construction projects. The president has threatened to veto the resolution if it passes below the 400, if it passes both the 435-member House and the 100-seat Senate, where Republicans hold a 53-47 edge, and its prospects are uncertain. The Democrats have denounced the emergency declaration as a power grab by the president and a violation of the Constitution because it usurps the power of Congress to decide government spending. At least two Senate Republicans, Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Senator Tom Tillis of North Korea, North Carolina, have said they would back the resolution overturning Trump's emergency declaration. Four Republicans would need to break ranks for the measure to pass the Senate, but neither chamber is likely to be able to muster the two-thirds majority needed to override an expected presidential veto. Should the measure clear both the House and the Senate and reach his desk, Trump would be faced with a stinging rebuke and cornered into issuing the first veto of his presidency. Trump's national emergency declaration gives him access to billions of dollars to construct the border wall beyond the nearly $1.4 billion allocated by Congress. Democratic leader or Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said on Monday that Trump's emergency order was an unconstitutional attempt to expand executive authority and strip lawmakers of the power to control how federal funds are spent. The president's power grab usurps that responsibility and fundamentally violates the power or the balance of power envisioned by our founders, Pelosi said. As several Republican senators expressed reservations about Trump's emergency declaration, the president sought to head them off. He says, "I hope our great Republican senators don't get led down the path of weak and ineffective border security," Trump tweeted on Monday before heading for Vietnam for a summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. "Be strong and smart," he said. "Don't fall into the Democrats' trap of open borders and crime." Republican senators Collins and Tillis have openly broken ranks already, and others appear to be wavering. While Trump is rightfully frustrated with Congress's inaction on border security, "The president made a mistake declaring an emergency," said Tillis. "I have grave concerns when our institutions, it looks the other way at the expense of weakening Congress's power," the Republican senator from North Carolina wrote in the Washington Post. "The emergency course is not one I favor," Senator Mitt Romney of Utah said. Well, Trump has said he is 100% certain to issue a veto if the House and Senate override his emergency declaration, and the White House reiterated that on Tuesday. "The current situation at the southern border presents a humanitarian and security crisis that threatens core national security interests and constitutes a national emergency," the White House said in a statement. "The southern border is a major entry point for criminals, gangs, and illicit narcotics. And dozens of Republican ex-lawmakers and a bipartisan group of former national security officers, including secretaries of defense and CIA directors, spoke out strongly against the emergency declaration on Monday. In a joint declaration, the 58 national security officials warned that an abuse of the Constitution. The group includes former Secretaries of State Madeleine Albright and John Kerry, along with George W. Bush's Undersecretary of State Nicholas Burns. "So under no plausible assessment of the evidence is there a national emergency today that entitles the president to tap into funds appropriated for other purposes to build a wall at the southern border," they said. So again, very, very compelling news. A lot of stuff going on, and we'll just see where that goes. One second. All right, this is really interesting. We spoke to you a little bit about this yesterday. Left-wing party has won a seat in parliament threatening Trudeau's Liberals. The leader of Canada's left-wing New Democratic Party and first member of a minority ahead of a major movement, Jagmeet Singh, has won his first seat in parliament. The NDP, the New Democratic Party, is expected to pull votes from Prime Minister Trudeau's Liberals in October elections. Jagmeet Singh, a practicing Sikh, was shot to prominence in October 2017 when he became the first ethnic minority leader of a majority federal political party in Canada. So at 40, his win in a by-election in a Vancouver suburb on Monday sets the stage for the NDP to deal votes on the left and hurt Liberal hopes of steal votes on the left and hurt Liberal hopes of hanging on to their majority in Parliament in the upcoming general election. So in the lead rather by uh, uh, or in the lead up to Monday's special ballot, Singh struggled with low national visibility and insider criticism of his leadership. And now with 8 months to go before the general election, he will face off almost daily against Trudeau in the House of Commons. The third-ranked NDP, however, lost another seat in Montreal held by Singh's predecessor to the Liberals. Meanwhile, the main opposition Tories, which are neck and neck with the Liberals in recent state opinion polls, held onto a seat in the Toronto area. And pundits were watching to see if an upstart People's Party led by former Tory Foreign Minister Maxime Bernier would split away significant votes from the Conservatives on the right, which would help the Liberals in October. But it barely registered in all three special ballots held on Monday. So it would be very, very interesting to see where all this leads. And so that's the story there. Let me still maintain our focus here in the Americas. And 1 second. Okay. I see. We should cover this. Evidently, President Trump is with you 100%, Pence tells Venezuelan opposition leader Guaido. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and Venezuela opposition leader Juan Guaido agreed to a strategy to tighten the noose around President Nicolas Maduro following a meeting with regional allies in Colombia on Monday. We hope for a peaceful transition to democracy, but President Trump has made it clear all options are on the table, said Pence, who passed on Trump's 100% support for Guaido. So the meeting came after four people were killed and hundreds injured as Guaido supporters clashed with Venezuelan security forces on the border with Colombia and Brazil. This took place all on the weekend in a thwarted bid to bring in humanitarian aid. The Lima Group, which is made up of Latin American countries and Canada, met in Bogota and said it would ask the International Criminal Court to declare the violence of Maduro's criminal regime against the civilian population and the negation of access to international aid as a crime against humanity. And Guaido warned that indulging Mexico would be a threat to all of Americans. So that was the state of affairs there. And that's it. So let's quickly go back and see if we have anything else in the Americas to talk about. Evidently not. And we're going to move over. We're going to move over to what's happening in Europe. So bear with me a moment. And this is really quite interesting. This is a report from Agence France, from France 24. Seems that a century after losing its empire, Germany's preparing to formally apologize for the massacre of the Herero and Nama people in Namibia. Crime is considered by historians to be the first genocide of the 20th century. In the past few years, a handful of activists and museum directors have helped bring this strange and dark chapter of history to the German public's attention. And the Agence France Press, the France 24 reporters are going to be making the report. The program was prepared by Patrick Lovett and Gael Essou. So let's hear what they've got to say. Bear with me a moment. Okay, we should be good.
Go. They know every nook and cranny of the African Quarter, a neighborhood whose name has gone unchanged since its construction before the First World War. For years now, Christian Kopp and Yakasuru Mboro have fought to rename its streets. They still bear the names of old German colonies and their governors. These people were not only responsible for conquering and establishing the colonies, but directly responsible for the various crimes that were committed in them. There's Luderich, Nachtigall, and Karl Peters, the German imperial governor who crushed the Maji Maji rebellion in Africa. Among its victims in modern-day Tanzania were members of Nyakasuru Mboro's family. Karl Peters. Was so brutal
in Tanzania
that he was nicknamed Bloody Hands. When I think of this brutality, and that there is now a street actually honoring him, I find it unacceptable. Thanks to a neighborhood vote, the name change should take place in a few months. A victory for these activists whose main objective is to put an end to what they call colonial amnesia. Germany has worked very hard to examine its conscience after the Second World War, but is only now really looking at this other part of its history. First in line are museums. Faces of slaves still adorn the facade of the Stuttgart Ethnological Museum, but inside, since 2 years back, they're digging into the archives.
There are studies on construction materials, on the architecture of the colonies, and obviously anthropological studies.
The museum employs two researchers to look into the origin of the collections.
It's serious work. We analyze and translate all the letters and documents that are here.
The hard work is paying off. 90% of the collection was gathered in the colonial era. To shed light on its provenance, the museum is organizing a new African exhibition and plans to restitute objects when possible. Late February will bring a first, when a Bible and a whip taken from Hendrik Witboy, a Nama chief and national hero, go back to Namibia. It's a big change for Germany. The museum director hopes it's just the beginning.
The colonial era is largely absent in our towns. There's no museum devoted to colonialism and this period of history. But you can sense a new awareness now. And I would like it if this discussion about restitution wasn't only taking place in museums. It should be a matter of broader public debate. The German public at large doesn't know much about the 30-year period of occupation, pillaging, and extermination.
But under pressure from the Namibian government and activists, Berlin is preparing to formally apologize for the genocide of the Herero and Nama peoples in Namibia. Still, for German MP Ottmar von Holtz, born in Namibia when it was still a colony, more must be done.
This subject has to be talked about in schools, and not only in history class. We have no monuments or special places for remembrance. But we need them in order for future generations to talk about what happened so that it becomes part of our collective memory.
One 100 years after the end of its empire, a little-known other dark chapter of Germany's past is coming to light. Estimates put the number of killed at 300,000.
Wow. Very, very compelling report. It's just very interesting to recognize that this is now being one of the focus that's taking place. Very intriguing. I've always wondered about that, but it just never made limelight, so to speak. So it's going to be interesting. All right. Well, evidently there's a bid to block Israel's prime minister. Attempt to boost a racist party. It seems that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has widely criticized attempts to boost a party many view as racist in April elections could be blocked if his opponents succeed in a bid to disqualify its candidates.
a range of politicians seeking to oust Netanyahu have supported a petition seeking to have candidates for the party, it's called Jewish Power, barred from participating in the April 9 election on the grounds of incitement to racism. And Netanyahu last week brokered a deal that saw Jewish Power join with two other far-right parties to form one list to boost its chances of making it into parliament after the elections. The prime minister, with an eye on his next coalition government, should he win, says the move was necessary to ensure enough seats in the next parliament for right-wing parties. But Netanyahu has received condemnation both at home and abroad over the move, with many accusing him of easing the pain for or the path for anti-Arab racists to make it to a parliament. Now, he has even faced rare criticism from pro-Israel organizations in the United States, including from lobbyist group AIPAC, and the American-Israeli Political Action Committee, which called the party racist and reprehensible. Quote-unquote, Jewish Power leaders are followers of late racist Rabbi Meir Kahane, and I don't know if you should call him racist, but some people designate him that way. His Kach movement was labeled a terrorist organization by Israel, the United States, and the European Union, and yet there's no other choice. Netanyahu is in the midst of tough negotiations, and it's that crisis that's going on now. So Netanyahu's in the midst of a tough re-election campaign while under the threat of being indicted on corruption charges. His right-wing Likud is not directly part of the pact between the right, far-right parties, though Netanyahu pushed to have the merger formed. We had no other choice. Likud officer Eli Hazan had told Israel's 24 television when asked why Netanyahu is basically okay with bringing racists into the Israeli parliament. We need to win the elections, he added, saying Likud did not want Arab parties or Arab-Israeli parties to help form the next government. Left-wing party Meretz filed a petition in the Central Elections Committee on Tuesday to have Jewish Power candidates disqualified. So we'll see where all that goes. Bear with me a moment as we look to see what else is going on. And this is interesting as well. Sensibilities, that's what it's all about. The Spanish King's inflammable statue sparks an art fair row. Want to burn a statue of Spain's King Philippe VI? Well, for 200,000 euros, it's a deal in contractual obligation. Even at Madrid's ARCO, Arco Contemporary Art Fair, where two artists known for recording controversy are showing a giant effigy of the monarch. The 4.44 meter statue that's 13 or almost 14 feet, reproduces the king standing tall and looking firmly ahead, wearing a dark blue suit, green ties, and white skirt. So that seems to be the equation there. To our studio screen. And bear with me a moment, so we'll see what's going on here. And I didn't realize it's just about 11:30. So instead of doing all those other things, let me quickly go back to our studio screen. And okay, we're cool here. And what I want to do is find out who we have tomorrow. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking to Laurie and John Wiles and Winston Morrow, and I think that we're getting a Ford 150 truck we're going to be talking about, so that should be fun.
And I don't think that Wynn will be able to make it with us tomorrow. Neither will Lori Wiles. But thank goodness there'll be John Mueller and myself at the helm. So I hope you enjoy it. Well, okay, so that's a story here at this end. Let me quickly go back to our studio screen. And let me just see. Okay, here we are back at the studio screen. So I'm going to wish you a good day, all the best, and thank you for being with us today. Hope you'll join us tomorrow. Goodbye.